This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the African American Studies channel on the New Books Network. My name is Brittany Edmonds, and I'm very happy to be speaking with Dr. Andy Hines today about his new book, Outside Literary Studies, Black Criticism and the University. Thank you for being here today, Dr. Hines.
Thank you.
So your story, your book largely tells the story of African-American writers and critics and their challenges to a mid-century formalist literary critical school known as New Criticism. And so I wanted us to start just by you kind of telling us a bit about New Criticism, about its institutional situatedness, and also why it might have been incompatible with at least, you know, some Black writers and sort of some Black texts and aspects of Black social life.
That's a wonderful way to get into the book, and in fact is, in some respects, how I got into this project in the first place. So I appreciate you starting there. I think the way that the New Criticism is most well known to us is that they brought close reading as the kind of methodological practice of choice for literary studies within the academy. And this institutionalization began largely in the mid-20th century in the 40s and 50s, though in the narrative of the book, I complicate this story a little bit that the New Criticism wasn't quite as coherent of an entity until in some ways many of its practitioners began to disavow it for politically complicated reasons. But the story that I tell about the origins of the New Criticism really is rooted in a group of thinkers in the South called the Agrarians, Robert Penn Warren, John Crow Ransom, Alan Tate being among the most prominent of them. And when we look back to their work in the 30s, you know, emerging out of the things that they did as the fugitive group at Vanderbilt, we find that they write this polemic of sorts called I'll Take My Stand, which is a book that calls for a return to the agrarian economy from industrialism. And one of the things that's particularly striking about this book is precisely the absence of Black people and Black life from this book, in which they're trying to reconcile a path forward for the South. And a return to agrarianism with the making invisible of Black people obviously raises some really important questions. There's one essay in the book by Robert Penn Warren called The Briar Patch that really embraces a Booker T. Washington approach towards kind of the industrial uplift of Black people. But however, Warren is very explicit about the role that Black people should continue to play in society, that this is not really a path for uplift, but rather a path for continued labor. And so the book, I'll Take My Stand, you know, reveals that there is a sort of political economic project to this agrarian tendency, and it's explicitly so. And I think one of the things that's not remembered about this group, like John Crow Ransom, for instance, you know, he wrote a sort of political economic treatise called Land in the years after this. One of the things that it reveals when we look that back to that as an origin for the New Criticism is that we see that this critical program actually has a kind of political economic project behind it. And so one of the things that I'm trying to kind of reveal in the book is that this political economic project, which many of these literary critics began to disavow in various ways in the mid-century, actually underpins in some ways, aspects of their methodological approaches, but that more significantly, they represent a way that critical practice is in relation to the state and the university and the capital. So a really important aspect of the agrarian story that often gets forgotten, or at least gets emphasized less. is that I'll Take My Stand, the original title for the book, was Tracks Against Communism. And so there's a clear thread that one of the fears about industrialization is that it brings together black workers, white workers, and also gives additional power to the state. And so the agrarians have a simultaneous fear of a kind of multiracial worker uprising, and also a powerful state entity that wants to suppress that. And so when we think about the ways that that might position or complicate the work of Black writers trying to enter into a conversation with the definition of literature that is so dominant, as the New Critics establish it, is that it the thought and the institutional practice which is tied to it explicitly positions Black writers as external to the kind of order, the political economic order that the New Critics seek to create, both within the university, but in their wider relations with the kind of racial liberal state. It pushes them to the outside, hence beginning some of beginning to kind of invoke aspects of the book's title. So I think the important thing to know, and I think the things that I would want readers to walk away with this, is to recognize the New Criticism certainly as something that we remember as a methodological intervention into what literary critical practice is. But maybe the more important way to think about it is that they didn't invent close reading, right? The New Critics sort of are crucial towards establishing a set of institutional practices and a set of relations between English departments, the wider universities of which they are part, and the state capital nexus that they are connected to. And that's a place of intervention where the book really encourages us to think, and it opens up space to see a widespread set of practices of Black resistance and Black challenges to that kind of institutional formation that New Critics establish.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I like how you answer that question. It's sort of layered and characteristic of how you advance arguments in the book, which I really appreciated. I guess my first question, following that, would be whether or not you could say more about how sort of what looks like a sort of methodology of literary interpretation is actually a wholesale ideological apparatus that connects what would seem to be disparate parts of society that are in various stages of transformation. I wonder if you could just say a bit more about that, because as you've just sketched, I know there might be some listeners who are like, okay, so they wrote some literary criticism and then,
Right.
Yeah. So I wonder if you could just say a little bit more.
Well, I think one of the things that it's important, one of the ways I answered this question in the book is that the Black writers who were being actively excluded from literary critical spaces in the university drew the same set of connections. And so in some ways, the history I offered is certainly one that I flesh out some in the book, but it's one that I'm pursuing that Black writers in the mid-century kind of also articulated, particularly Black writers on the left. And, one of the things that they recognize is precisely the ways that the New Critics become entangled within the U.S. state at this particular moment. And so I think that this is a place where the narrative of the book really intersects with the history of the university, which is to say that, the mid-century moment is obviously remembered as a crucial one for the expansion of the massive expansion with the number of students due to the GI Bill. Later in the later 50s, the National Defense Education Act, which kind of extended those protections to more students. And so in that sense, the New Criticism in certain quarters is remembered as a kind of a mass democratic movement. There were more students entering into the academy. Therefore, close reading, which departed from philological and more explicitly kind of biographical or literary historical methods of teaching, made it so, or at least the kind of history goes, made it so that students who did not have familiarity in those subjects could easily access and read and interpret literature. And I think one of the things that's important to point out was that this method that is about kind of resolving a series of tensions within a poem into a kind of unified reading, and seeing the complicated dimensions of that resonates very deeply with the kind of e pluribus unum of the United States, the kind of melting pot philosophy that there's this tension that's kind of being drafted into sort of one identity, which is something that the New Critics themselves talk about. There's this moment in the book where I talk about how John Crow Ransom thinks about how a poem is very much like a democracy, which becomes a sort of important ideal. But when we look historically, you know, and I think that this is a kind of point that is moved quickly over in Gerald Graff's history of the profession, but that new critical methods were much more successful at more elite institutions than they were at the mass institutions like CUNY schools or, wider public education systems, that the students in those institutions had more trouble with the kind of abstraction of close reading. And so that, in fact, that this method that was meant to be democratic and that largely had the kind of support from state forces who were seeking to create and generate a kind of general education curriculum for a sort of mass public, which we have to remember is largely white, despite the large increase of people entering into universities, that this is still very, very much informed by segregation, still very much informed by the limitations of GI Bill benefits at this period. That this methodology only reaches a certain set of people nevertheless. And so that one of the reasons that literary criticism is so important in this moment is precisely because it enters into and intersects with a kind of political economic function of the state that's wanting to absorb a lot of soldiers who are coming back from World War II who may not have jobs. This is a very complicated economic moment. It's a very radical political moment for workers. I think that that's something that's not often remembered about the post-war moment. And so I think that it's kind of meant to marshal some of those forces into the academy. And so the one of the reasons why literary criticism is so important is because it kind of shapes the ways that we think about the humanities and even certain social sciences in this mid-century point. And so it kind of becomes to be, and whether this is fair or not, I think is up for debate. And, you know, it's an interesting conversation to have, but it literary studies in the mid-century becomes to be a sort of, metonym for the university more broadly, right? And I think the other thing too is that, and I also touch on this briefly in the book, but that, you know, new critical methods, and I think people like William Maxwell have talked about this some degree, you know, become kind of incorporated into the state security apparatus. So that this is not just a kind of analogy, that actually these methods themselves become ways that the FBI and the CIA are reading Black writers and Black literature, and so become a force of control. And so I think, you know, the book highlights how quickly a sort of literary critical method at a certain historical point can take on wide scale ramifications within the state. And in that sense, it's a crucial dimension towards reproducing aspects of not only anti-Black racism, but forms of anti-communism, and also really invested in reproducing aspects of American imperialism beyond the United States as well.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I think, you know, my first question following that would be, you know, the Southern agrarians that you name, sort of given all of that you've laid out, right, and how this sort of new sort of methodology sort of infiltrates various parts of society, I'm curious about whether or not you see the folks you name as the sort of Southern agrarians as this sort of being an intentional political project, or is this something that's unfolding, you know, as a result of a confluence of a bunch of the things you just named, right, of the sort of burgeoning student population within the university, sort of et cetera,
Yeah.
I'm just curious.
No, well, I think
it's intentional political.
Well, I think it's multi-form, right? On the one hand, you have Donald Davidson, who's an agrarian writing, I think, in the American Review, which was a sort of right-wing political magazine that also did a lot of cultural work in the 30s. You have him writing that generating a literary critical methodology in an anthology textbook is an important way to kind of establish a sort of cultural dominance. And the way to do that is through the university. You have him writing this in the 30s before Clarence Brooks and Robert Penn Warren generate their really important textbook called Understanding Poetry, which you know, then and now is remembered as maybe perhaps the most pivotal poetry textbook for the development of literary studies, you know, which went into four editions. So that there's, in some senses, there's really explicit links between those things. But I think at the same time, I think the agrarian project wouldn't have gotten off the ground if it wasn't tied to other sort of political and economic developments. And I think one of the interesting kind of intersections is that, you know, the agrarians had a sort of political and economic influence beyond literary studies. You know, this is in some ways an atmospheric connection, but, you know, James Buchanan, the Virginia School economist, you know, Melinda Cooper has done some really important work on him, as has Nancy MacLean in her book, Democracy in Chains. And, you know, Buchanan was deeply influenced by some of, or at least was inspired in part towards developing this kind of, you know, version that would eventually pair, you know, conservative and kind of neoliberal philosophies, obviously later on, in part through his contact with figures like Donald Davidson at Vanderbilt, or at least, you know, being aware of and being influenced by these figures when he was in Tennessee. And so I think that one of the things that I hope that the book kind of touches on a little bit is that this is part of a sort of broader movement that feels quite familiar in this moment. The kind of dialectic of anti-communism and racism is one that very much shapes our present. And obviously there are people who are telling that stories through political and economic thought more explicitly. But I think what we see is that literary studies is also kind of involved with that shift. And I think one of the things that I would add to this also is that, you know, one of the things that happens in the mid-century, and then this is, I think, distinct from our own moment, right, is that that Ransom, Tate, Warren, who become really important national figures, many of them are among the first of, you know, what would eventually be referred to as the Poet Laureate of the United States. They were all very much affiliated with the Library of Congress. They give out this public award to Ezra Pound, who at the time is accused of treason. And which becomes a very controversial moment for the New Criticism that I document in the book. But that, you know, they recognize that part of their success and their challenge against communism, racism, communism and their embrace of racism must be channeled through a kind of state form of liberalism. Becomes to be a kind of consensus around this. And that, you know, modulates the ways, the discourse that they use to describe some of these things. And it also kind of drives their turn towards, you know, cultural production or assessing cultural production and away from their discussion of the kind of explicit politics that many of them carry. And I think that in turn kind of shapes the ways that we've thought about the history of literary studies as being one that's largely shaped by methodological developments rather than entangled with these kind of broader political and economic shifts that, as your question kind of initially indicated, the book seeks to kind of connect or at least draw a sort of complicated web of contingency and cause that the New Critics and their method are very much involved in, and that brings the Black writers who seek to challenge it into a wider sort of conversation that addresses not only, you know, the method of how literature is defined or how we read literature, but engages therefore how that method is connected to the aims of capital, the aims of the state, the aims of the university. And so I think that provides, you know, one trajectory for thinking about the broader relation of New Criticism to kind of political and economic developments within the U.S. and the world at this particular time.
Yeah, so I'm curious about whether, you know, sort of given what you've outlined, whether the sort of implicit racialization of New Criticism, its implicit elitism, its sort of methods that are carrying out, as you say, the sort of work of capital and the work of the state. I'm curious if there were sort of challenges to New Criticism that issued from sort of other domains, you know, so other than sort of Black writers, sort of Black literary criticism. And if there were, do those sort of other critics of New Criticism, are they saying many of the same things that sort of Black writers and Black critics are saying about New Criticism?
That's a great question. And I think it's a complicated one, in large part because One of the arguments in the book is that the New Critics and their institutionalization was so forceful that they shape, you know, our understanding of literary critical history to a really intense degree. My brief answer to that would be, yes, there were people who were making left critiques of the New Criticism. Many of them were also affiliated with the Communist Party, and many of them even were affiliated with the Jefferson School of Social Science, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit, of which there were a lot of Black writers affiliated, and that was a really, was many things, but among them was a hub for Black left cultural thought. But there were people like Martha Millett, who was a poet and a critic there, and Sarah Ehlers in her book Left of Poetry kind of details the ways that she, is making this kind of long argument about New Critics and the ways that they're invested in turning the poem into a commodity fetish, which of course is like, or turning it into a commodity and thinking about it in terms of commodity fetishism, which was something I was reading as I was finishing the book, which is, mirrors an argument that I make. And so that there's an interesting connection there. And I think that there is, there's a lot of folks who are, actively thinking about the kind of ways that non-academic critics who are working in these kind of political spaces, were working outside of the kind of main ambit of the university and sort of proto-feminist spaces and others, were making these kinds of critiques of the New Criticism. But I think, and so there's that piece. But another piece is that, a lot of the times that this divide gets broken up is that some people will say, oh, well, there's, there's the agrarian New Critics like Ransom, Tate, and Warren. And then there's the sort of New York intellectuals, which are, represented, maybe more so by a figure like Lionel Trilling or something like that. And there are certainly, minor methodological philosophical debates that are going on between those groups, which is one of the things that divides up those schools. But ultimately, I would sort of argue that they come to a kind of consensus position around a certain liberalism. And I think that that necessarily means that the agrarians certainly concede certain aspects of their political program to kind of agree with a sort of more center-left positioning by some of those critics, but that it otherwise pushes out sort of more significant dissent away from this kind of mid-century, away from our narrative and remembering of this mid-century moment. And so I think that that's another dimension too, is that it kind of makes that all critical, literary critical debate in this mid-century moment, at least in the way that it's most typically remembered, is about a kind of somewhat, internecine battle around the kind of definition of liberalism and its relationship to literary criticism, which I think is an interesting conversation, but I think it suppresses a sort of wider political challenge that was going on in this particular moment with the particularly motivated and animated, though besieged, left in the United States that had new and interesting imaginaries for the position of Black people, workers, feminist thought together at this particular moment in a way that is, quite familiar to the ways that we think now, but that was very difficult to kind of recover, in part because of the strong force of the institutionalized practice of this kind of debate, this debate around liberalism that became the kind of consensus position in the mid-20th century.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, where I wanted to go is I wanted to ask you about whether or not, there were like Black New Critics. And I wanted to ask that question because I was really interested in the anecdote that ends your second chapter, where Robert Hayden says something like, I don't want to be called a Black poet. And Melvin Tolson is like, oh, that's ridiculous. And so, but I think given how you just answered this question, if I'm hearing you correctly, that why it's kind of difficult to talk about this sort of formation that you are analyzing is that it is a methodology, but it's also a kind of ideological way of sort of viewing the world, of upholding certain kinds of understandings in order to produce and also sort of make impossible certain social realities and possibilities for all these emergent populations mid-century during a time of transformation. And so it seems to me like you might say that, yeah, maybe there were Black New Critics, but it doesn't really matter, right? Because this sort of that kind of methodological concern is not really how New Criticism is operating sort of beyond the academy to do certain kinds of ideological work. So is that what you would say, that like, sure, there were debates about how to sort of read literature, and sure, there are Black folks who could sort of be invested in sort of formalist methods, but at the end of the day, the work that New Criticism is doing sort of beyond literary culture and criticism itself is of such a sort of different and more slippery valence that to talk about it that way is to like miss the point.
I think I agree in part. I mean, I think there are, the book chronicles very briefly in its third chapter on Langston Hughes and Arna Bontemps's kind of back and forth about Richard Gibson and James Baldwin's inclusion in an issue of Perspectives USA. The Gibson essay is called A Note of Nothing, which happened to also be the first essay, or one of the first essays published by a Black writer in the Kenyon Review, which was a sort of very dominant new critical venue. Gibson, I believe, had a fellowship at Kenyon, so it was with Ransom at the time. And then the essay in question that's being republished for the third time, actually, in Perspectives USA is, of course, Baldwin's Everybody's Protest novel. And what Hughes and Bontemps are talking about is that they kind of can't believe that Baldwin and Gibson are, knowingly or not, throwing their hat into the ring with the New Critics and the New York intellectuals. They kind of see them as perhaps just not knowing the history of these particular thinkers and explicitly kind of invoke it. Despite admiring Baldwin's writing to an intense degree, Hughes and Bontemps are just quite surprised that he's willing to kind of be republished in this particular venue. You know, after this essay is published, Hughes reads a novel by Baldwin and is kind of writes to him and says, I'm kind of surprised at what you're writing about in this novel with regard to race and your position on it, I'm surprised at this based on what you had previously written in Everybody's Protest novel. And I think that this, this lines up with, Lawrence Jackson kind of does a reading of Everybody's Protest novel and The Indignant Generation that aligns aspects of it with new critical thought. And so this is not to say that Black writers couldn't be invested in these kind of conversations, and some of them were. I think the question becomes, for me at least, is that how does that push out other forms of Black political and cultural engagement, whether it's directly with New Criticism or otherwise. And I think, the mid-century is a great place to think about this, in large part because for so long, our understanding of it was shaped by Wright, Baldwin, and Ellison, two of which were kind of, disavowed communism after, various engagements with it. And Baldwin, of course, Baldwin becoming in some degrees, increasingly radical, recognizing in some part, though not disavowing necessarily, but recognizing a more complex relationship to liberalism as his career proceeds, right? And so I think that it highlights that there is a kind of world apart from those modes of engagement with this type of critical thought. And there's also there's worlds apart from the types of engagement with communism in that part by mid-century Black writers. And one of the things that my book seeks to open up is that there were a large number of Black writers who were engaged explicitly in leftist thought and were, whether openly communist or not, had deep ties to activities of the Communist Party at a moment when the Communist Party had, say, elevated Claudia Jones to a policymaking position when it came to the women question in the U.S. And so that there is a sort of more complex landscape that I would argue that that a focus on exclusive focus on Black writers who were engaging with New Criticism and a kind of in the same venues as them and explicitly kind of encountering them kind of covers over this wider political landscape that's important to recognize, in part because there were literal alternative institutions being formed, but also other ways of thinking about not just literary interpretation in general that like cared about materialist concerns, but that also thought about a kind of materialist form of formalism, that it's not like just It's not like one group is interested in reading the text and the other group is just like, let's look at the political world around it as a way of shaping it. That, you know, in the book, I talk about Melvin Tolson, who's very invested in a certain form of formalism in the kind of literary critical practice that he implies in his tête-à-tête with Alan Tate around Tolson's poem, The Libretto for the Republic of Liberia. So I think that, like, that's also a way to think about it, that it, that even a term like formalism isn't exclusively available to academic or, you know, isn't exclusively available to academic definition, but also isn't exclusively available to the definition of these other kind of middle magazines like the Kenyon Review, Partisan Review, et cetera, that were operating in this mid-20th century that had such a crucial role to play in the definition of literary critical practice.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I asked the question, and we're going to sort of transition to talking about Melvin Tolson, but is that I'm curious. I mean, so far we've been hearing somewhat of a kind of right-left story. And so I'm just curious, are there challenges to new criticism that don't issue from the left? And if there are, is the character of those challenges sort of drastically different than the ones that do? Are all the challenges sort of, given how new criticism operates in that sort of mid-century moment, do they all carry with them sort of political implications, or are there moments where we can see that is not the case? I mean, I think for me, my interest is sort of figuring out why new criticism especially seems to be so adept at adjudicating what are certain contradictions in liberalism during this sort of period of time, but also about how all these sort of different practitioners who do have different politics, I mean, sort of as you just noted, even between the agrarians and someone like the New York intellectuals, how it is they do come to understand themselves as being, you know, a part of a project that's nevertheless does advance a set of principles that have a loosely unified set of consequences institutionally, politically, and even culturally. And so that's where the questions are coming from. So I'll leave that in the air because I do want to sort of pivot to thinking about Tolson, and I think it's related. But your second chapter is called Melvin B. Tolson's Belated Bomb. And there you're sort of, as you already alluded to, you're investigating sort of Tolson's solicitation of Alan Tate for preface to his work, to Tolson's work, Libretto for the Republic of Liberia. And so maybe we could start by thinking just, you know, why did Tolson solicit Tate? What was that about?
Well, my argument is that Tolson writes to Tate because he is invested in getting, he wants to start a kind of debate about the terms of new critical formalism. And Tate largely takes him up on this. And Tate writes a preface to his book, or preface to this work of poetry. Tolson had been named the poet laureate of Liberia, despite the fact that he had never been to Liberia before, which is a whole other dimension that we can sort of talk about. But that he asked Tate to write this preface. Tate responds and says, you know, Tolson has kind of is the first black poet to kind of achieve the greatness of modern poetry. And this is a really interesting line, in part because Tolson more or less writes to Tate in a letter this line himself. He says, I kind of initiated this moment, this turn to a sort of modernist style in black poetry, which Tate kind of repeats. But later in, you know, the Dudley Randall relays a story that Tolson had told him, which was that Tolson tells Randall that he initially wrote to Tate with a draft of the poem, and Tate said, I won't write this. And then Tolson claims that he revised the whole poem. And after revising it, Tate said, like, wow, like, you actually have done it. Like, now I'm going to write the preface for it, which sort of implies that Tate would only kind of accept the poem in a certain style. Tolson's biographer, Robert Farnsworth, shows quite clearly that this is a myth. He like has the initial like letter that Tolson wrote to Tate and that Tate wrote back, and Tate like never turned him down. He may have like not answered very quickly or something like that, but there's not a clear rejection. And so it seems clear that when Tolson received Tate's preface, Tolson was excited, but also in kind of continuing his correspondence with Tate, realized that for Tate, suggesting that Tolson had finally kind of arrived at the criteria of modern poetry was not the kind of achievement that Tolson was imagining that it had been. And so Tolson embarks on writing an essay, about his correspondence with Tate that he hoped to publish in the Sewanee Review, which was at the time, more or less, Tate had been editing, had just wrapped up a stint editing there. And this essay is a remarkable document for its attempt to kind of critique the New Criticism on multiple fronts. It's to catch Tate in his own contradictions about what establishes the achievements of modern poetry and thinking about the ways that Tate is reading, does a kind of a reading of his own poem, Ode to the Confederate Dead, at the same time as it's about Tolson addressing this kind of weird instance that that Tate comments on in their correspondence. And the story that Tate comments on is Tolson says, I was relayed this story of an older Black person in Detroit at a library in Cadillac Square reading your poem Ode to the Confederate Dead. And Tate writes back and says something to the effect of, I told a sociologist friend about this anecdote, and they said something about, I wonder if he even understands about the intentions of the people in the in that poem and how they were against that. And I'm using air quotes for those not seeing, but that Uncle Remus in the library. And Tolson becomes really kind of invested in debunking or analyzing Tate's response to this narrative. And one of the things that it's clear is that, the anecdote that Tolson is telling is about a Black person reading this poem in the library where there's a kind of massive labor uprising going on around them. And so that there's this other kind of, political dimension to this aspect that Tolson is kind of invoking, that Tate and the new critical methods and the also kind of sociological methods of the mid-century kind of refuse to see this context for the possibility of Black reading in this moment. And Tolson here is drawing on his relationship with the sociologist Oliver Cox, who taught at the same place at Wiley College very briefly as Tolson, and they became kind of friends and corresponded over a while. Oliver Cox, of course, the author of Race, Caste, and Class, which is a sort of important materialist critique of sociology and race thinking in this moment. And so I think one of the things that this, Tolson invites Tate into is to have a sort of public debate about the terms of New Criticism. But the realities is that debate ended up being largely one-sided, in part because Tolson's essay, which he hoped to publish, which he never quite finished, there's about like 90 pages or so in the Library of Congress of lots of fits and starts, never was published in the Sewanee Review. And so the conversation more or less ended with Tate's judgment of Tolson in the preface, and then this kind of swirling rumor about whether Tolson intentionally revised his poem to kind of invoke that response from Tate, which Tolson seems to be the source of.
Yes, and so I'm curious if you could say more about, you characterize Tolson as sort of positioning himself between two worlds. And you say that he's not sort of after resolution, but about the kind of revolutionary potential that emerges from existing between those two worlds. And so I wonder if you can say more about how Tolson positions himself and about how that positioning, and these are your words, reconfigures the literary, social, and political order. And you touched on it a bit in that answer you just gave, but I wonder if you could, put a finer point on it, I'll say.
Yeah, I think so. Tolson has in a later poem, which is, again, has a number of layers, but this poem, Harlem Gallery, he has a character named Heidi Ho Heitz, who's a kind of a poem who or is the figure of a poet who readers are invited to kind of compare to Tolson. He is the author of a poem called E and OE, which wins this award. Tolson has published a poem called E and OE, which won the Poetry Magazine Best Hokan Award, and I think it was in the late 40s, early 50s. So there's an alignment there, and that one of the kind of scenes is this poet, you know, experiencing this dialect, the quotation is something like the dialectic of to be or not to be a Negro poet. And that this is kind of that in the way that that gets figured in the poem is, you know, does one embrace a kind of modernist style, you know, akin to the work of Eliot and others, or does one embrace a sort of social realist style? That these seem to be the options for a Black writer in the mid 20th century, a Black poet. And I think Tolson wants to hold that dialectic kind of in check. He wants to suggest that, and he, you know, invokes this in his conversation with Tate and also with, you know, his correspondence more broadly, but Tolson's poetry is notoriously difficult. It's not easy. And even people at the time were critical of this, including other Black writers. And Tolson really did not appreciate the suggestion that he should make his poem less difficult to write down to. Again, it's a court of, you know, suggesting that he should write down to the Black masses. His poetry is, in Tolson's imagination, written for a kind of Black future to come, where suddenly the kind of difficulty of his poetry is not difficult as soon as it is wrenched from a world that is so invested in the differentiation of the color line. And of course, this is a sort of invocation of Du Bois in his thinking on the color line. And this, and my reading of the betweenness is very much informed by Nahum Chandler's kind of you know, wonderful reading of the beginning of Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk, focusing on, you know, the between, that one of the things that Du Bois is thinking about is not necessarily choosing one world over the other, but rather about the kind of strange experience of Blackness as being precisely that between space, the kind of operable, you know, operating between these worlds. And I think that one of the things that Tolson seems to embrace in his poetry is that precisely that betweenness, and the bomb that he's seeking, this kind of like metaphorical, like explosion in letters, is tied to a sort of geopolitical explosion, which is, you know, of course, can't ignore the kind of nuclear age context here, but I think is also really about, for Tolson, not just resolving a Black world into a white one, or exclusively kind of resolving the universalism that's associated with modernism into a sort of African-informed understanding, but rather it's about creating a new universalism altogether that is kind of separate and distinct from the production of those two worlds. And so that's what his poetics are offering, or at least they seek to offer, and in the sense that when that new world is created, the masses will understand, you know, the density of reference that Tolson offers and the complexity that he provides. So that it's not that the masses can't understand it; it's that the context prevent the Black masses from understanding his poetry at this particular moment, and that his discourse with Tate seeks to kind of lift up that dimension, and why he is so why he takes on such a degree of frustration with the critique that you know, Tolson should be modulating his style to write down, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I do want to move to your third chapter, but I think I'm still confused about Tolson's lie, I mean, his myth, whatever you want to call it. I have a hard time making sense of it, given what you've laid out. Like, why would he lie about revising his poem to suit Tate? And how would that forward his goals in the ways that you described, his sort of literary critical goals? It's still for me like a confusing story.
Well, it is a confusing story. Yeah, I think it's absolutely confusing. And the other thing I would say is that, to lie about it is to show that he is smarter than Tate, right? That he tricked Tate into endorsing a black poem, which is something that I think he saw, rightly so, that Tate otherwise had a resistance to. So on that simple level alone, I think the kind of intrigue that Tolson seeks to create is that, you know, in some ways, there's a trickster dimension to it, right? And I think that one of the things that I am interested in my own reading of this kind of episode and this creation of this event that kind of ultimately failed to take off is to suggest that Tolson is doing a little bit more than that, that it's not just about pulling one on Alan Tate, that there was a sort of wider, both critical and in some ways like world historical kind of event that Tolson wanted to put on. And perhaps that's a certain degree of like hubris that he thought that like this could occur. And it's not surprising to see that given some of like Tolson's writing and his thinking about himself. But I also think, and I don't mean to say that like Tolson actually thought he could like write a poem and it would like radically change the world, right? But I think that he saw a sort of historical significance to the things that he was doing. But I think that it highlights that one of the things that Tolson wanted to ultimately get was a kind of victory against Tate in whatever form that took. And perhaps as a sort of invitation to begin to think about the kind of the wider political dynamics of new critical interpretation and also their impression on their impression on the ways that we think about Black writing. And I should add that, you know, I'm not alone in being intrigued and confused, as you are. I mean, there's a lot of scholarly engagement with this particular narrative that's gone on for a decade by, you know, people like Matt Hart and Kathy Lou Schultz and Michael Berube, you know, and others who are really, really tried to kind of parse their way through this. But I think one of the things that I hope to do and, you know, kind of with the archival turn towards this, you know, particular essay and other things is to point out the ways that Tolson, rather than simply identifying that there is a kind of choice between modern poetry and, a sort of social poetry for Black writers, that Tolson's very much invested in trying to explode the existence of those categories in the first place, which I think alters the ways that we might think about the choice that Black writers had towards what their poetics or what their literary style might be in the mid-20th century. And I think, to me, that's where Tolson seeks to go. And I agree that the artifact that we're most publicly left with makes that very difficult to see, and has also kind of shaped our scholarly understanding of this episode.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Yeah. I mean, what's just weird about it is he was trying to trick Tate, but it turned out to not be necessary. So, you know, it just seems like it falls flat. Like, and maybe Tate still didn't take him seriously, right? He used his own language in the preface, but even so, you know what I mean? It just makes his point kind of moot. Like, not only is Tate sort of not threatened by anything that Tolson might write, but it means nothing to him, whatever he thinks of the poetry, to lend his name to a preface. You know what I mean? It just seems like it makes everything that Tolson's doing impotent. And so that's why it's like the staging, the lie, seems so weird to me, because it's like, well, at the point where you're lying about it, I mean, what? Well, it just seems so incoherent. Right.
Yeah, well, I think it highlights and Tolson's register for thinking about this, even in the libretto, and I know we want to move on to other things, so I'll just say this one thing, but I think his register is like deeply invested in the philosophy of history, and in some ways like the philosophy of philosophy, right? It's like a very particular discourse where Tolson wants to intervene in this conversation. And I think that that emphasis de-emphasizes the kind of real political power that and real institutional power that the new critics had, both you know, in their relationship with the American state and also with the university. And so I think that that, like, and it's not to say that Tolson didn't understand that. I think he understood that also, you know, but I think it's to say that the approach that Tolson takes overemphasizes the kind of epistemological battleground. When I think that some of the other figures in the book that I described, like Hughes, a number of Black communists like Doxie Wilkerson, Lorraine Hansberry, later Du Bois, see that an engagement with the new criticism and the university is a much more grounded materialist political battleground that certainly has epistemological ramifications, and that needs to be addressed and approached too, but that there's also real coherent structural challenges that need to be made in order to address this formation. And so I think Tolson is illustrative because he has perhaps in the book the most like kind of utopian imaginary of what a world beyond this new critical nexus would look like. But in that sense, that overplays that dimension of his thought. And so I think that might, in some ways, that's an interesting way to clarify or to you know, approach that confusion that you're thinking about. And it's useful. Yeah, I appreciate it because it's useful for me to think about it and articulate it that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense that he's just in this little nerdy, like, discursive battle, and everybody else is just like, yeah, but I have more power than you.
Right.
Like, whatever. Right. It doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah, no, okay. That makes sense. So let's turn to your third chapter, which centers on Langston Hughes and is entitled Tactical Criticism. So you can just tell us, you know, what is tactical criticism, and also why is Hughes so central to our understanding or your understanding of what's going on during this period?
Yeah, so the chapter looks at Hughes's executive session testimony before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which is... you know, of which Senator Joseph McCarthy has a crucial role. Hughes is invited to give testimony because his poetry has been published or has been purchased by the federal government, and they want to know if he's a communist or not. And this executive session testimony, which was private testimony, was sealed for 50 years, released in 2003. And in it, Hughes is much more... fiery with his responses to the committee than he was in his public testimony, where I believe it's Arnold Rampersad who wrote that in the public testimony, Hughes was, I think his Rampersad's words were passive or even supine in his kind of remarks there. But here, Hughes is much more willing to kind of take on the committee and also articulate a mode of reading poetry. And what is tactical about it is that, you know, I'm taking that from Michel Desarteau, who's kind of thinking about the kind of tactics of social movements versus the strategy of the state. In other words, these kind of, you know, I'm also thinking too of Robin Kelly's use of that term when he sort of thinks about the kind of tactical acts of work stoppages or slowdowns or, you know, work stoppages or slowdowns or other small acts of resistance that might not otherwise seem like planned acts of resistance, but are nevertheless acts of resistance, right? And I think that one of the things that Hughes kind of seeks from the committee is a definition of, one, what communism is, and also what it means to read poetry. And I think what the chapter reveals is that Hughes throughout this period is really kind of challenging in a very coded way, the relationship of new critical reading practices to the definition of what good literature is, and the ways that good literature is kind of coded as a literature that embraces certain forms of white liberalism. And one of the reasons why I say coded is because this is a moment where Hughes is facing a lot of scrutiny for his relationship to communism, and that Hughes is basically broke. He has having speaking appearances canceled, and so has to be quite careful about his critique of any sort of aspects of what are seen to be liberal cultural practices and liberal interpretive methods from the left. He has to be really careful about that, or else he's going to be further ostracized. And so we see Hughes kind of stating through this coded discourse of the ways that there can be other modes of interpretive practice of Black poetry that are also themselves forms of knowledge making that are tied to a wider Black tradition of critical practice and of, you know, of interpretive practice that he kind of links this up to. And so one of the ways the book thinks about this is through Black autobiography, which Hughes seems to invoke and kind of reproduce in his own testimony. But it also looks at Anne Petrie's novel, The Narrows, and kind of thinks about the resemblance of the protagonist of that novel having to kind of undergo a similar set of anti-communist and racist scrutiny to articulate a kind of mode of Black life and Black interpretation of Black life that kind of gets obscured. So that there's a sort of line that Hughes is kind of implicitly connecting certain aspects of Black interpretive practice in this moment through what he's attempting to do in this closed door hearing in Washington.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's great. Just because of time, I do want to move to thinking about the Jefferson School. I mean, it's the longest chapter in your book, and, you know, I'll admit I didn't know much about the Jefferson School. And so that chapter is entitled Culture as a Powerful Weapon. And so can you tell us about the Jefferson School, its approach to the academic study of Black life, Black literature, and also its sort of impact?
Yeah, so the book, you know, ends in, you know, there's an epilogue beyond it, but the book ends with this. If one aspect of the argument of the book is that the institutionalization founded by the New Critics, or that the New Critics are kind of motivating within the University for Literary Studies, that Black writers are actively challenging that, one of the things that is crucial to that challenge is the formation of alternatives. And the Hughes and Tolson chapter offer discursive alternatives and methodological ones as well. But the Jefferson School chapter offers the fact that there, you know, is a literal material alternative that's tied to communism. And so the Jefferson School of Social Science starts in 1944. It lasts until about the late 50s, when it is forcibly closed, basically by constant federal intervention. It's a school for, it's building on a sort of longer tradition of socialist and communist schools that are aimed at working people. Most of its students are working people. Most of its students are women. Most of its students are, at least it overrepresented Black students in New York than the population of New York. So, which was an explicit aim of the school. One of the things that I argue in the book that's distinct from some of the other work on the Jefferson School, of which there is not a lot, but I would be remiss to mention the, you know, really pivotal work of Marvin Gettleman, the late historian who wrote, you know, two or three really crucial articles on kind of bringing this institution to the forefront. But that one of the things I focus on is the study of Black culture within these institutions, and particularly the role of someone like Doxie A. Wilkerson, who had worked at Howard before leaving the Communist Party, became a columnist for the Daily Worker, and then himself became the director of curriculum. And when Wilkerson became the director of curriculum, while there were courses being offered on Black life and Black culture at the Jefferson School, the amount of offerings really transformed with him coming into place. You saw courses being taught by Du Bois. Later, Lorraine Hansberry taught a course there. Lorraine Hansberry was a student there. John Killens was a student there. You have courses on Black literature. You have courses on racism in the medical profession. You have a wide variety of inquiry, both into contemporary sociological modes of thinking, but also, you know, various modes of political thinking. The Jefferson School itself kind of becomes the hub of this in New York, but I also draw on the fact that it seems to be adopting some of these methodological practices from the George Washington Carver School, which was located in Harlem, of which it was affiliated. It took over the George Washington Carver School in the 40s after that school had been closed, again, due to some these weren't federal challenges, but these were challenges from a kind of liberal establishment to the role that a left-oriented school would play in Harlem, but that was led by the writer Gwendolyn Bennett, who really was invested in establishing a pedagogical practice and a methodological practice that sought to put Black working people in direct conversation with Black cultural workers, that she was deeply invested in the fact that there need not be and should not be a separation between those two groups of people, that there shouldn't be the investment of a set of intellectuals who then speak for a Black community that they invent, or that they are, that they should be deeply connected to that conversation. And so, one of the things that I point out in the book is that, Gwendolyn Bennett, the artist Elizabeth Catlett, are deeply invested in creating these kind of pedagogical and methodological practices that seek to put into conversation the work of everyday Black working people with Black cultural production, and that kind of informs an approach to literary critical practice, but that also informs an approach to the institution for higher learning separated from the kind of forces of racial liberalism that we've spent, a lot of the first part of this interview talking about, what that might look like in some form or another. And so that's, in part, that's one of the roles that the Jefferson School plays in the book, is that it's not that this is just an imaginative otherwise, that there actually was a kind of institution that was outside or beyond the university and racial liberalism as we've come to imagine it, that was doing some really critical work, certainly for the study of literature, that needs to be kind of put in conversation with our own literary histories, but also that informs and engages a longer history of Black studies that is not exclusively focused on the creation of a disciplinary practice that's inserted into the academy. It highlights a longer tradition of Black studies that is connected to Black mass movements and the Black radical tradition, of which Black studies in the 60s did, but that there's a long conversation about the ways that has been incorporated and reconfigured once entering into the university system. So this is a kind of sort of prehistory, a lesser known prehistory to that movement, and gives us material to think about as it relates to it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, just for my last question, I think it's related to this vein of thinking, and I want to return back to something that you said early in the interview. You called literary studies, at least sort of mid-century, a kind of metonym for the university and for humanities thinking generally. And I wondered if you would say a bit about, especially as you're sort of getting into this prehistory of Black studies and thinking about these alternative modes and institutions that exist outside of the university space, I wonder if you would say that that's still the case, if literary studies is still a metonym for the university. And if it's not, I wonder what you would say to, how we should understand our interpretive practices, especially since, it's very topical in this moment, right? But if literary, do you still think literary studies has that kind of centrality? And if it doesn't, what does that mean for the impact of the ongoing debates we have about interpretation, et cetera, within the university?
Yeah, I think that this is like a hard question. It's a hard question to answer, because I feel like, the answer actually isn't hard. I just feel like it's, in some ways, it's like a hard truth to swallow, right? Which is, I think the answer is no, like it does not hold that position. But I think, and this is the hard part, is that the discipline itself as a structure is really having a hard time grappling with the fact that it is not in that position any longer. And I think, I was recently having a version of this conversation with some people. And I think one of the things that's challenging is that, you know, literary studies about, you know, 30 years ago at this point was the kind of premier place to think about difference and left politics within the academy. I mean, I'm sure some people will raise their hands and say maybe not, but I think that there was a way that I think if you wanted to study certain forms of, if you wanted to enter into certain modes of what we now call minority studies discourse, that literary studies was the place to do it in the 90s, right? And I think that that's no longer the case. I think that there are a number of reasons for that. But I think one of the things that's crucial is that that is no longer the case. And I think that literary studies is, goodness, is seeking to resolve its position, its imagined position within the academy as shaping humanities discourse in a very strong way, which was, of course, tied to a large number of majors, of tied to its position within the curriculum towards establishing writing, which trends within English departments themselves, separating writing departments from English departments, things like that have kind of complicated this story. But that it is no longer the kind of the beating heart of humanities discourse. What is? I'm not sure, quite frankly. I think that that's a very complicated question. But I think one of the things that the book asks us to reckon with, given that position, is in order to have a better answer than the one I'm providing now, one of the things we have to reckon with as a discipline, if I'm wanting to, if we, whereas if I'm identifying with the discipline right now, which I have, we could, whatever, we're, this is our last question, we'll have a long conversation about it maybe afterwards. But I think what I would say is that what my book reveals is that one path towards understanding the position of literary studies within the academy is to think about literary studies and its relationship to the formation of the academy in a historical sense and also in the present. I think the epilogue of the book invites us to think about how methodological changes within literary studies are not the only way to think about the discipline's history. And that I think thinking about the ways that the discipline's formation and its impact on, say, labor practices within the academy, its impact on what the academy is imagined to be able to do, what certain modes of thinking are available to do, that that is crucial. Understanding that that trajectory of thought is crucial towards thinking about the position of literary studies now. And my, you know, maybe it's a polemic argument, but my sort of polemic is that there's a lot of work to be done in terms of that. And so that understanding the actual position of literary studies as it relates towards the wider aspect of the university, the wider aspect of humanities thinking more broadly, is an area where there's a lot of inquiry to be done that can be informed by the kind of materialist understandings that aspects of my book, you know, seek to offer us.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It was really great to talk to you today.
Yes, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.